Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
From Hamilton, Ontario, this is the Green Planet Monitor, your weekly report on Earth systems, human development, justice, and science. Today, in Ottawa, legislation that would have halted Canadian military support for U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza fails. And the second part of a conversation about critical education with Canadian academic Henry Giroux. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. First, news headlines with Kylie Wong.
A proposed poultry laying facility at the University of Saskatchewan has received a $6.2 million investment aimed at strengthening agricultural research and improving poultry production. The investment is being funded by the Canadian Foundation for Innovation. Once approved by the University of Saskatchewan, the facility will hold 6,000 hens. Dr. Karen Swain-Wardner, a poultry researcher at the University of Saskatchewan, said there is nothing in North America right now like this proposed facility. It is the first of its kind. Students at McMaster University have voted to develop a policy that would allow the McMaster Students Union to support student strike actions in the future. On Friday, March 13th, the McMaster Student Union held its General Assembly at Burge Gymnasium. For the first time since 2015, the Assembly reached a quorum of 3%. This means the votes are binding on the Student Representative Assembly, which require them to act on the Assembly's motions. The motion was supported by Students Against Austerity, an activist group at McMaster that grew out of support of QP 3906, Canadian Union of Public Employees. The same apps people use to learn languages on their phone is helping a McMaster University professor uncover clues about how the brain learns words. Linguistics professor Victor Cooperman is working on an AI-powered language learning tool that will simplify text for users, collect data about the user's language skills, and evolve as their skills improve. The tool would also consider the user's linguistic background and use shared vocabulary where possible. This will be there for someone who wants to progress in their English or their French, who wants to start processing text in these languages, the languages they need for everyday life, Cooperman said. A group of McMaster University students is using the month of Ramadan to organize a charity aimed at helping vulnerable people in Hamilton. Nora Abdullal and Zainab Nazir founded Ramadan Giving in 2021, a youth-led grocery initiative. The group serves hundreds of vulnerable families from Hamilton and Brantford to Oakville and Whitby. Their client list has grown through word of mouth and social media outreach. It started as a way to help people during Ramadan, but we wanted to take that spirit of Ramadan giving and carry it to give back to families of all backgrounds and all faiths, said Abdullal. And that's the news.
Week in the Canadian House of Commons, a private member's bill aimed at halting all arms shipments to Israel was defeated. Bill 233, an act to amend the Export and Import Permits Act, also known as the No More Loopholes Act, failed by a vote of 295-22. On the positive side, 15 members of Mark Carney's pro-war liberal government voted in favor of closing the genocide loophole. Another 15 members of the Liberal caucus abstained. Canadian anti-war activists see that as a victory. The No More Loopholes Act did not mention Israel or any other state. Israel-USA's genocidal war on Gaza was clearly on the mind of the parliamentarian who tabled it last September, New Democratic Party member Jenny Kwan. A year before that, in early 2024, the Gaza genocide well underway, and Justin Trudeau still prime minister, his foreign minister Melanie Joly announced that new arms shipments to Israel would cease to be permitted regardless of their route. Old export permits would be honored. As it turns out, reported by Canada's independent journal, The Maple, bombs, ammunition, and spare parts for the F-35 fighter bomber and other high-tech systems continued to flow to Israel via its conjoined twin, the United States. In the lead-up to last week's vote on the No More Loopholes Act, a handful of Canadian anti-war and human rights organizations lobbied parliamentarians to support it. Rachel Small is Canada organizer for one of those groups, World Beyond War. What was this act about, the No More Loopholes Act?
It's been a huge honor for me over the past, I think, nearly 2 years at this point to coordinate the Arms Embargo Now campaign cross-country, which has brought together, I think we're well over 450 organizations across the country now, including the country's biggest unions and civil society organizations and faith institutions, et cetera, all pushing for a full arms embargo on Israel. That means an end to the flow of all weapons and all military goods between Canada and Israel. And there's been much, much organizing over the past several years towards that goal. There's been lots of wins along the way. But increasingly, what we began to realize is that a majority of the weapons that were continuing to flow from Canada to Israel were going via this U.S. loophole, is what we called it in Canadian law, which basically means that unlike if any company wants to export weapons from Canada to any other country on Earth where they'd need a permit, where it would need to go through some kind of approval process through Global Affairs Canada, conveniently all weapons exports to the U.S. are exempted. It means there's no tracking, there's no permitting process, there's nobody who's looking at what are these weapons going to be used for, where are they bound for, etc. So that is a key way that Canadian weapons have continued to move to Israel. They're being exported from Canada down to the United States, and then either built into weapon systems that are then sold to Israel or just literally like re-exported onto Israel. We put out a huge report in, I suppose it was just in this past December, where we traced hundreds of shipments of everything from explosives and fighter craft, aircraft fighter parts. It was hundreds and hundreds of shipments that we were able to individually track leaving Canadian facilities, going to, in many cases, the U.S.'s biggest bomb factories that are then, of course, supplying Israel with the 2,000-pound bombs, with the 155-millimeter shells, etc., that have been their primary weapons of genocide. So it seemed clear that we had to do something to close this loophole, and we're very pleased that MP Jenny Kwan was able to introduce a private member's bill in Parliament aimed at closing that loophole, and also tightening up Canadian arms exports in a few other ways, adding some more transparency and aligning how arms exports regime actually works with what Canada said it was following, which was adherence to the Global Arms Trade Treaty. So Canada is a signatory to that, and that's excellent, but our arms export laws don't actually align what we do with what we promise to do as a country under the Arms Trade Treaty. So it was an excellent bill, in my opinion, and the Arms Embargo Now campaign has been very happy to support it. I should note that the bill does not specifically mention Israel, because this is not an issue unique to our arms exports that are used in Israel's violence. That's been such, obviously, a striking case over the past few years of the ways that Canadian weapons are being used in some of the most horrific war crimes on the planet. But I should also note, just since the start of this year, we've documented the use of Canadian weapons in the U.S.'s bombing attacks on Venezuelan ships. Canadian-manufactured armored vehicles have been used by ICE in Minneapolis, in like this, literally on the same moments that they're killing civilians on the streets. Millions of dollars of Canadian parts are in every single F-35 that's being used to bomb Iran and Lebanon right now. So I should just say, like, this is not certainly an issue exclusive to the attacks on Palestine, but that's been a really notable case to observe this problem in action. So this vote finally came to pass, as you mentioned, in the last week. And unfortunately, Prime Minister Carney shut it down, and they did pick the side of Trump and Netanyahu's war crimes, despite the fact that we handed the Liberal government a real opportunity to turn their kind of endless rhetoric into actual action. They doubled down on ensuring really this uninterrupted flow of Canadian weapons to these escalating wars and war crimes.
And it's interesting that on the one hand, the Canadian government feels obliged to say, no, we're not going to send arms and lethal lethal weapons and munitions to Israel, given the fact that since October 2023, what's been going on? And Melanie Jolie said, no, we're not sending weapons to Israel anymore. But at each step of the way, they're looking for loopholes that will enable them to actually do that, saying, oh, we're not sending, what we're sending aren't lethal arms. And then, of course, saying, well, we're sending it down to the United States. We don't have any control over that. So on the one hand, the government feels somehow that it's obliged to say that it's cognizant of what's going on in Palestine, Israel's genocidal war on Gaza. On the other hand, it's totally committed to keeping the flow of arms going.
Yeah, and I mean, the reason they do feel obliged in that way, and I'm so glad that you noted that, is 100% just based on the epic organizing and mobilization of just like many tens of thousands of people. Those are just like who is showing up at the offices on the streets, but backed by millions of people across the country over the past more than 2 years to say, yeah, that any Canadian complicity that continues in Israel's genocide is just deeply unacceptable. And we have moved Canada's foreign policy position on Israel like radically over. We've had a huge impact. We've moved the country from, oh, of course, we're going to keep arming our biggest ally in the Middle East, which was the position a couple years ago, to, no, of course, Canada is not arming Israel. And we did force them to indeed pause and suspend some permits, to take some actions to limit the flow of some weapons. But, I mean, frankly, the huge change we've seen, even just in the period between when this bill was getting ready to be introduced and now, is that the Liberal government, I mean, this has been a big change in moving from their leadership under Trudeau to Carney, but also even just for the last few months, has just more and more, with this bill, we are now basically opposing Carney's central vision for Canada and its economy and its foreign policy, which is the war on militarism in lockstep with Trump, are his central vision. Like, everything Carney's actions, whether it's the vote on the bill, but also his 2025 budget for the country, which is a war budget, his military industrial plan, his bid for Canada to literally host the global headquarters of a new global war bank, the DSRB, his support or back
what's
and forth.
What's that about?
Confusing.
Tell me about that.
Support. Yeah, I mean, so basically.
DSRB, what's this?
Yeah, I'll say that in a sec. But just to finish, I think that over the past several months, what we've seen is that the government has decided that militarism is the point, is its central kind of goal here, and is its central vision of how Canada will have prosperity and what its foreign policy will look like. And that means that by the time we came to a vote on this bill, we were no longer just creating a way for them to match their words with actions. We were confronting their kind of central agenda. And in that context, the fact that we got 15 Liberal MPs to vote in favor of the bill and 15 Liberal MPs to abstain from voting. So that's 30 Liberal MPs who broke rank from the Carney government on this, which is huge and is vastly larger breaking rank and fractures within the party than has happened since he's been elected in a year. So I think this is really telling. And obviously, we wanted this vote to pass. We wanted to change Canadian law permanently for the better. And I won't deny that loss. And that's deeply disappointing and shameful. However, we did create this really substantial fractures within the Liberal Party that I think are notable and I think pave the way for all kinds of future organizing. But to come back to your question about the DSRB, yeah, the Canadian government is being very, very keen right now about being a central kind of supporter and playing leadership in this brand new war bank. It's essentially like a finance arm of NATO's war machine. It's designed to fund and accelerate a global arms race. It was a new bank that was pitched late in 2025, and it's set to launch later this year. It's going to have dozens of countries who are members, NATO members and considered allies. It's basically meant to serve as this hub where public money is used to solicit ever more private investment in weapons and military industries. And right now, Toronto is bidding to host the global headquarters. World Beyond War with some allies have just launched a campaign saying, you know, absolutely not in our city, not in our country, and frankly, not on planet Earth. Like, the last thing we need right now is a war bank to shuttle even more funding to these, like, bloated billionaire arms companies and arms dealers.
What does DSRB stand for?
It stands for Defense, Security, and Resilience Bank. But we're calling it a war bank because that's what it is.
Ha. Anita Anand, the foreign minister, Canada's foreign minister, said, quote, it is irresponsible to propose a bill like this, the No More Loopholes Act. The changes would decimate Canada's defense industry, weaken Canada's role in NATO, and jeopardize capabilities of our Canadian armed forces, the No More Loopholes Act. Can you comment on that?
I mean, I think that's like ridiculous and really disingenuous. I mean, and if it's true that it would decimate Canada's arms industries for them to be forced to have to say what the weapons are for or to apply for a permit, like that's a really damning indictment of the Canadian arms industry. And frankly, I just I don't think there's any way in which that's true. I would say that what this would actually do is move Canada's arms control regime in sync with many, many other countries around the world, and would actually, in some ways, facilitate Canada's role as an arms dealer. That is not World Beyond War's agenda, but frankly, having your legislation be more harmonized with the other countries that have signed on to the arms trade treaty, like many European allies, the Crimea has said, want to have closer relationships with, I think would be helpful. But I mean, just to put it simply, like what Bill C-233 does, it doesn't actually ban any trade in arms sales. And that, frankly, could be considered a weakness in the bill from those of us who do want to actually stop the flow of these harmful weapons. But what it does is it ensures that those weapons actually have to go through proper human rights review, right? So, like, to say that that would shut down the industry, for the industry to have to consider the human rights requirements that the country already says it has to require, like, it's kind of just sheer nonsense to sort of say that. And frankly, for the government, it feels like, well, either you're admitting that arms exports to the U.S. are likely to lead to human rights abuses and breaches of international law, and that's why they can't go through a permitting process, or there's no problem here, and in which case the bill is not going to interrupt the flow of those weapons. So it feels like a catch-22. They've sort of gotten themselves stuck in.
Mark Carney got a whole lot of publicity and compliments and kudos from around the world, including here in Canada, from amongst some people who consider themselves or claim to be progressive, about his speech in Davos, Switzerland, several months ago, supposedly bemoaning the collapse of what he calls the rules-based international order. Not international law, not the UN Charter, but the rules-based international order. In fact, if you read his comments closely, he's not bemoaning the collapse of the rules-based international order. He's saying, we've got to accept that this is the current climate in which we exist in. This is the reality, and we've got to adapt to that. But we know that, you know, the Carney government, the Trudeau government before it, really had no commitments to upholding its commitments under the UN Charter, under the Fourth Geneva Convention, under the Genocide Convention, that it claims to support these conventions. But in fact, where the rubber hits the road, it doesn't really. It denies a genocide is going on in Gaza. It says the settlement enterprise is unlawful, but it extends aid and assistance to the settlement enterprise and resists attempts to stop doing so. So clearly, you know, Mr. Carney, he doesn't seem to have very much commitment to the post-World War II international legal order, beginning with the United Nations Charter.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I mean, I think that, you know, that despite talking on his election campaign and his Davos speech about, you know, kind of elbows or separating from the U.S. or resisting the big bully or whatever, when we look at what he's actually done, and as I mentioned, like when you actually look at his actions, what they really are is an effort to move Canada, I mean, for me, horrifyingly, really at breakneck speed down a path that's based on ever-increasing militarization and warmongering in direct alignment with the U.S. And I mean, I think that if this wasn't already clear, like the Canadian government's full-throated support for Israel and U.S.'s horrific, wildly illegal bombings of Iran, starting a new regional war, like make that just extremely clear that, I mean, sure, Carney's now saying, oh, we're not actually going to send troops, and that's excellent, and he's maybe doing some backpedaling, I would say, based on just, like, the huge backlash to his initial very full-throated support. But if we look at, as I mentioned before, like his defense industrial strategy, which is throwing around $500 billion to ramp up military production, promising that he's going to ramp up arms exports by 50%. I mean, besides the fact that these are kind of nonsense, imaginary numbers, like there's no way of saying you're going to ramp up exports by 50%. That's you promising that other countries are going to buy what you're making when they also are ramping up their domestic production. But even the imaginariness of these numbers aside, I think he's making it really clear what his agenda is. And it's this deeper and deeper military integration between Canada and the U.S., far beyond continuing just the existing relationship.
Why does Mr. Carney, I mean, you can't speak for him, but why do you think that his position is that Canada, that the Israel, Canada-Israel relationship is sacrosanct? I mean, Trudeau thought this before him, and I think all Canadian prime ministers since 1948, since 1967, have declared that the relationship between Canada and Israel is sacrosanct, that Canada must be a really good friend of Israel. Like, why is that? Why is it that Canada cannot simply, for example, cancel the Canada-Israel Free Trade Agreement or suspend it, given the fact that Canada itself acknowledges that the settlement enterprise is unlawful and prevents a two-state solution, which Canada declares is absolutely essential that there be a two-state solution, and the settlement enterprise compromises the two-state solution, but Canada extends aid and assistance to the settlement enterprise. Yes. And really, to the destruction of Gaza. Israel is totally free to do anything it wants to do as far as the Canadian government is concerned. Why?
Mm-hmm. I don't know that I'm the best person to speculate at a really deep level about kind of the full history and ongoing relationship of that. I will say that Canada and Israel are both like settler colonial states, and I think the Canadian government identifies with that relationship. And I mean, Canada is a country built on the removal of Indigenous people from their land. And I think that it makes a lot of sense that even at a basic level, the Canadian government would identify much more with the Israeli state than any kind of Palestinian body at that basic kind of colonial violence level. But I think that Canada's relationship with Israel is very, very tied up with Canada's relationship with the U.S., as we've talked about, and like really struggling to ever have an independent foreign policy than the U.S. Like, for many years, there's been this like idea of, oh, we are so different from our neighbor to the south, and we are the peacekeepers of the world, and we are this and we are that. But really, if you look at it, like, Canada has, I mean, Cuba might be a bit of an exception. There's a few exceptions, but really, Canada has had a foreign policy that's just been kind of dictated by the U.S. and its relations with Israel and with other states.
Rachel, what's the strategy amongst anti-war and social justice and human rights advocates in Canada, such as World Beyond War? What's the strategy to impose pressure upon those Canadian arms manufacturers and munitions manufacturers and components manufacturers to get them to stop building things that end up in the components of the Israeli genocidal machine?
Yeah, I mean, there's many strategies and there's many different campaigns that we've been part of. As I mentioned, we've put out these with other allies and in really close collaboration, especially with the Palestinian youth movement, put out these hard-hitting reports to, first of all, just expose the flow of weapons, because even that has been completely under wraps, and it has really taken these meticulously researched reports that have caused panic for the Canadian government when they've been released and have put them sort of on a back foot and needing to explain, oh, is this true? Are we actually sending these weapons? So frankly, a lot of this starts with actually uncovering what is the true state of affairs, what is the flow of weapons actually looking like? And we've put together a map at worldbeyondwar.org/Canada Stop Arming Israel that shows hundreds of spots across the country where there are companies, be it their factories or their offices, that are connected to arming Israel. So I would encourage people to go there and look up who in my community is a company that is connected to the Canada-Israel arms trade. And really, in every city in the country, you will find various dots on the map, and it explains what the connection are. So part of it, I would say, is finding what's been hidden, what's been kind of deliberately concealed by both the government and these companies has been one aspect of the strategy. We've been working with grassroots groups like truly in every corner of the country to figure out what they can do locally that will make a material difference. And in some cases, that has looked like weapons factory blockades, where hundreds of folks have showed up at the crack of dawn and literally stopped workers from entering into the factory that day. I mean, workers are not the enemy here, and we're always looking to make worker allies. We have a whistleblower tool for any workers connected to the arms industry or the military who would like to share information confidentially, and many have taken us up on that offer. But yeah, supporting workers also in saying, actually, we don't want our labor to be connected to arming this horrific violence. Many different types of direct actions, protests, other things that have kind of directly interfered with the flow of weapons, be they, I mentioned factory blockades, but also blocking rail lines, highways, etc. There's been hundreds of actions like that over the past few years, some of which we've been honored to be able to be part of. Similarly, blocking weapons fairs and places where the arms industry gathers and makes decisions and deals and literally shows off weapons of genocide in some cases. We have had some really notable successes in the past few years as a movement that I think are worth highlighting. Notably, just recently, huge win. And this by no means belongs. I take no credit for this. This is the work of many, many thousands of people across the country, and World Beyond War was just a small part of it, but successfully getting Scotiabank to fully divest from Elbit Systems. This is huge. Scotiabank was the largest foreign investor in Elbit, which is, of course, Israel's biggest weapons company. For this major Canadian bank to be forced to sell all of its shares in Elbit is, I think, a huge victory for our movement. And that really directly interrupts the flow of capital to this company and also delegitimizes others' investment in Elbit. Like, if one of Canada's biggest banks was forced to divest, that's a much easier sell about why everybody else should also be divesting when it's not a stable investment or something they want to be associated with. I mean, I mentioned some of the reports that we put out as a result of one of them, where we really tracked shipments leaving Canadian facilities, and in that case, going straight to Israel, and it's straight to Elbit factories in Israel. Just one example is we forced a company, Calian, a defense company based in Ottawa, to promise to stop all shipments to Elbit because of just the scrutiny and the scandal, basically, of them being associated with these things. And I mean, for me, one area that has not been looked at enough in the context of an arms embargo is the purchases of Israeli weapons by the Canadian state. So we've got our eye on a whole bunch of contracts that are underway or not yet underway, where the Canadian government, be it through local police forces or the RCMP or the military or prisons or border services, are buying all kinds of Israeli weaponry and often surveillance tech from the same companies that are arming Israel's genocide. So interrupting, and that's the flow of like Canadian taxpayer dollars, like directly to often these Israeli state-owned weapons companies. So it's interrupting that is a really direct material disruption of the Israeli war industry. So, but yeah, I in terms of sort of some bigger next direction from the Arms Embargo Now campaign, I would say stay tuned and more will be coming out very shortly.
Do activists come out of the campaign against Canadian arms shipments to Israel via the U.S. supporting the No More Loopholes Act, which was defeated? Do you folks come out of this campaign stronger than you were when you went into the campaign? Do you feel?
Yeah, I mean, I think it can be hard, obviously, in movements when there are more losses than wins, and that's usually how it goes. And you work really hard towards a particular outcome, and you don't get the outcome that you want. But I ultimately think, like, that this bill was really a litmus test, and I think really indicative to lots of people. Like, wow, we gave the Carney government just the clearest possible moment where they could have picked a side, and instead they picked the side of militarism and U.S. weapons companies. And I think that's actually really useful information for our movements. And that said, Carney and his inner circle, who fought from the beginning to ensure this bill would be defeated, they wanted nothing more than it to be swept under the rug, right? To live in the shadows. And we really made that impossible, from the press to the streets. I think we embarrassed the government. I think we made the disgraceful state of affairs really undeniable. And I mean, I've been talking a lot about the Canada-Israel arms trade, but just the day after the bill was voted down, there was a protest at Rochelle, the armored vehicle manufacturer I mentioned before, to try to interrupt the flow of their weapons to be used by ICE. And World Beyond War right now is working with a lot of Sudanese allies to figure out what we can do to interrupt Carney's ongoing trade deal negotiations with the UAE, because the UAE is, of course, arming the horrific violence in Sudan. Like, I think that once people, for example, discover a